Chapter 8 suddenly glared back at me like a human mask of hate. The loudest cannonade had not made him seem as real as that. At this point the military lines and the old political frontier everywhere overlap, and in a cleft of the wooded hills that conceal the German batteries we saw a dark gray blur on the gray horizon. It was Metz, the promised city, lying there with its fair steeples and towers, like the mystic banner that Constantine saw upon the sky. Through wet vineyards and orchards we scrambled down the hill to the river and entered Pont de Mausen. It was by mere meteorological good luck that we got there, for if the winds had been asleep the guns would have been awake, and when they wake poor Pont de Mausen is not at home to visitors. One understood why as one stood in the riverside garden of the great Premonstratensian monastery which is now the hospital and the general asylum of the town. Between the clipped limes and formal borders the German shells had scooped out three or four riadful hollows, in one of which, only last week, a little girl found her death, and the facade of the building is pockmarked by shot and disfigured with gaping holes. Yet in this precarious shelter Sister Theresia, of the same indomitable breed as the sisters of Clermont and Gerbeviller, has gathered a miscellaneous flock of soldiers wounded in the trenches, civilians shattered by the bombardment, eclipse, old women and children. All the human wreckage of this storm-beaten point of the front. Sister Theresia seems in no wise disconcerted by the fact that the shells continually play over her roof. The building is immense and spreading, and when one wing is damaged she picks up her protégés and trots them off, bed and baggage, to another. "Je promène mes malades," she said calmly, as if boasting of the varied accommodation of an ultra-modern hospital, as she led us through vaulted and stuccoed galleries, where caryatid saints look down in plaster pomp on the rows of brown blanketed pallets, and the long tables at which haggard eclipses were enjoying their evening soup. May 15th. I have seen the happiest being on earth. A man who has found his job. This afternoon we motored southwest of Nancy to a little place called Menil-sur-Belvet. The name is not yet intimately known to history, but there are reasons why it deserves to be, and in one man's mind it already is. Menil-sur-Belvet is a village on the edge of the Vosges. It is badly battered, for awful fighting took place there in the first month of the war. The houses lie in a hollow, and just beyond it the ground rises and spreads into a plateau waving with wheat, and backed by wooded slopes the ideal battleground of the history books. And here a real above-ground battle of the old obsolete kind took place, and the French, driving the Germans back victoriously, fell by thousands in the trampled wheat. The church of Menil is a ruin, but the parsonage still stands, a plain little house at the end of the street. And here the cure received us, and led us into a room which he has turned into a chapel. The chapel is also a war museum, and everything in it has something to do with the battle that took place among the wheat fields. The candelabra on the altar are made of 25 shells, the Virgin's halo is composed of radiating bayonets, the walls are intricately adorned with German trophies and French relics, and on the ceiling the curé had painted a kind of zodiacal chart of the whole region, in which Menil-sur-Belvet's handful of houses figures as the central orb of the system, and Verdun, Nancy, Metz, and Belfort as its humble satellites. But the chapel museum is only a surplus expression of the curé's impassioned dedication to the dead. His real work has been done on the battlefield, where row after row of graves, marked and listed, as soon as the struggle was over, have been fenced about, symmetrically disposed, planted with flowers and young firs, and marked by the names and death dates of the fallen. As he led us from one of these enclosures to another, his face was lit with the flame of a gratified vocation. This particular man was made to do this particular thing. He is a born collector, classifier, and hero worshipper. In the hall of the Resbiter hangs a case of carefully mounted butterflies, the result, no doubt, of an earlier passion for collecting. His specimens have changed, that is all. He has passed from butterflies to men, from the actual to the visionary psyche. On the way to Menel we stopped at the village of Krevik. The Germans were there in August, but the place is untouched except for one house. That house, a large one, standing in a park at one end of the village, was the birthplace and home of General Lyody, one of France's best soldiers, and Germany's worst enemy in Africa. It is no exaggeration to say that last August General Lyody, by his promptness and audacity, saved Morocco for France. The Germans know it, and hate him. And as soon as the first soldiers reached Krevik, so obscure and imperceptible a spot that even German omniscience might have missed it, the officer in command asked for General Lyody's house, went straight to it, had all the papers, portraits, furniture and family relics piled in a bonfire in the court, and then burnt down the house. As we sat in the neglected park with the plaintive ruin before us, we heard from the gardener this typical tale of German thoroughness and German chivalry. It is corroborated by the fact that not another house in Krevik was destroyed. May 16th. About 2 miles from the German frontier just here as well as front, an isolated hill rises out of the Lorraine meadows. East of it, a ribbon of river winds among poplars, and that ribbon is the boundary between Empire and Republic. On such a clear day as this, the view from the hill is extraordinarily interesting. From its grassy top, a little aeroplane cannon stares to heaven, watching the east for the danger speck, and the circumference of the hill is furrowed by a deep trench, a owl, rather winding invisibly from one subterranean observation post to another. In each of these earthly warrens, ingeniously wattled, roofed and iron-sheeted, stand two or three artillery officers with keen, quiet faces, directing by telephone the fire of batteries nestling somewhere in the woods 4 or 5 miles away. Interesting as the place was, the men who lived there interested me far more. They obviously belonged to different classes, and had received a different social education. But their mental and moral fraternity was complete. They were all fairly young, and their faces had the look that war has given to French faces. A look of sharpened intelligence, strengthened will and sober judgment, as if every faculty, trebly vivified, were so bent on the one end that personal problems had been pushed back to the vanishing point of the great perspective. From this vigilant height, one of the intentest eyes open on the frontier, we went a short distance down the hillside to a village out of range of the guns, where the commanding officer gave us tea in a charming old house with a terraced garden full of flowers and puppies. Below the terrace, lost Lorraine stretched away to her blue heights, a vision of summer peace. And just above us, the unsleeping hill kept watch, its signal wires trembling night and day. It was one of the intervals of rest and sweetness, when the whole horrible black business seems to press most intolerably on the nerves. Below the village the road wound down to a forest that had formed a dark blur in our bird's eye view of the plain. We passed into the forest and halted on the edge of a colony of queer exotic huts. On all sides they peeped through the branches, themselves so branched and sodded and leafy that they seemed like some transition form between tree and house. We were in one of the so-called villages, nedgers of the second-line trenches, the jolly little settlements to which the troops retire after doing their shift under fire. This particular colony has been developed to an extreme degree of comfort and safety. The houses are partly underground, connected by deep winding aisles over which light rustic bridges have been thrown, and so profoundly roofed with sods that as much of them as shows above ground is shell-proof. Yet they are real houses, with real doors and windows under their grass eaves, real furniture inside, and real beds of daisies and pansies at their doors. In the colonel's bungalow a big bunch of spring flowers bloomed on the table, and everywhere we saw the same neatness and order, the same amused pride in the look of things. The men were dining at long trestle tables under the trees, tired, unshaven men in shabby uniforms of all cuts and almost every color. They were off duty, relaxed, in a good humor, but every face had the look of the faces watching on the hilltop. Wherever I go among these men of the front, I have the same impression. The impression that the absorbing, undivided thought of the defense of France lives in the heart and brain of each soldier as intensely as in the heart and brain of their chief. We walked a dozen yards down the road, and came to the edge of the forest. A wattled palisade bounded it, and through a gap in the palisade we looked out across a field to the roofs of a quiet village a mile away. I went out a few steps into the field, and was abruptly pulled back. Take care, those are the trenches. What looked like a ridge thrown up by a plow was the enemy's line, and in the quiet village French cannon watched. Suddenly, as we stood there, they woke, and at the same moment we heard the unmistakable grrr of an aeroplane, and saw a bird of evil high up against the blue. Snap, snap, snap barked the mitrailleuse on the hill. The soldiers jumped from their wine, and strained their eyes through the trees, and the Taube, finding itself the center of so much attention, turned gray tail and swished away to the concealing clouds. May 17th. Today we started with an intenser sense of adventure. Hitherto we had always been told beforehand where we were going, and how much we were to be allowed to see. But now we were being launched into the unknown. Beyond a certain point all was conjecture we knew, only that what happened after that would depend on the goodwill of a colonel of chasseurs a pied whom we were to go a long way to find, up into the folds of the mountains on our southeast horizon. We picked up a staff officer at headquarters, and flew on to a battered town on the edge of the hills. From there we wound up through a narrowing valley, under wooded cliffs, to a little settlement, where the colonel of the brigade was to be found. There was a short conference between the colonel and our staff officer, and then we annexed a captain of chasseurs and spun away again. Our road lay through a town so exposed that our companion from headquarters suggested the advisability of avoiding it, but our guide hadn't the heart to inflict such a disappointment on his new acquaintances. Oh, we won't stop the motor, we'll just dash through, he said indulgently, and in the excess of his indulgence he even permitted us to dash slowly. Oh, that poor town when we reached it, along a road plowed with fresh obus holes, I didn't want to stop the motor, I wanted to hurry on and blot the picture from my memory. It was doubly sad to look at, because of the fact that it wasn't quite dead. Faint spasms of life still quivered through it. A few children played in the ravaged streets. A few pale mothers watched them from cellar doorways. They oughtn't to be here, our guide explained. But about 150 begged so hard to stay that the general gave them leave. The officer in command has an eye on them, and whenever he gives the signal they dive down into their burrows. He says they are perfectly obedient. It was he who asked that they might stay. Up and up into the hills. The vision of human pain and ruin was lost in beauty. We were among the firs, and the air was full of balm. The mossy banks gave out a scent of rain, and little waterfalls from the heights set the branches trembling over secret pools. At each turn of the road, forest, and always more forest, climbing with us as we climbed, and dropped away from us to narrow valleys that converged on slate-blue distances. At one of these turns we overtook a company of soldiers, spade on shoulder and bags of tools across their backs, wrench workers swinging up to the heights to which we were bound. Life must be a better thing in this crystal air than in the mud welter of the Argonne, and the fogs of the north, and these men's faces were fresh with wind and weather. Higher still. And presently a halt on a ridge, in another black village, this time almost a town. The soldiers gathered round us as the motor stopped. Throngs of chasseurs a pied in faded, trench-stained uniforms for few visitors climbed to this point, and their pleasure at the sight of new faces was presently expressed in a large vive l'Amérique. Scrawled on the door of the car, l'Amérique was glad and proud to be there, and instantly conscious of breathing an air saturated with courage, and the dogged determination to endure. The men were all reservists. That is to say, mostly married, and all beyond the first fighting age. For many months there has not been much active work along this front, no great adventure to rouse the blood and wing the imagination. It has just been month after month of monotonous watching and holding on. And the soldiers' faces showed it. There was no light of any enterprise in their eyes, but the look of men who knew their job, had thought it over, and were there to hold their bit of France till the day of victory or extermination. Meanwhile, they had made the best of the situation, and turned their quarters into a forest colony that would enchant any normal boy. Their village architecture was more elaborate than any we had yet seen. In the colonel's ugat, a long table decked with lilacs and tulips was spread for tea. In other cheery catacombs we found neat rows of bunks, mess tables, sizzling saucepans over kitchen fires. Everywhere were endless ingenuities in the way of camp furniture and household decoration. Farther down the road a path between fir boughs led to a hidden hospital, a marvel of underground compactness. While we chatted with the surgeon, a soldier came in from the trenches. An elderly, bearded man, with a good average civilian face, the kind that one runs against by hundreds in any French crowd. He had a scalp wound which had just been dressed, and was very pale. The colonel stopped to ask a few questions, and then, turning to him, said, "Colin, feeling rather better now?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. In a day or two you'll be thinking about going back to the trenches, eh?"
"I'm going now, sir."
It was said quite simply, and received in the same way.
Oh, all right," the colonel merely rejoined.
But he laid his hand on the man's shoulder as we went out. Our next visit was to a sod-thatched hut, at the sign of the ambulant artisans, where two or three soldiers were modeling, and chiseling all kinds of trinkets from the aluminum of enemy shells. One of the ambulant artisans was just finishing a ring with beautifully modeled fawn's heads, another offered me a piquel hop small enough for mustard seeds wear, but complete in every detail, and inlaid with a bronze eagle from an imperial pfennig. There are many such ringsmiths among the privates at the front, and the severe, somewhat archaic design of their rings is a proof of the sureness of French taste, but the two we visited happened to be Paris jewelers, for whom Dyson was really too modest a pseudonym. Officers and men were evidently proud of their work, and as they stood hammering away in their cramped smithy, a red gleam lighting up the intentness of their faces, they seemed to be beating out the cheerful rhythm of "Two will something make, and joy in the making." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.